This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zympht. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Hi, it's Deborah Kale Earnshaw here with my poem this week. Wendell Berry is a writer and a farmer who has long championed small-scale farming and strong local communities and the necessity of living in harmony with the natural rhythms of the earth, or we perish. It's called The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things, who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free.
Thank you, Deborah Kale Earnshaw, for setting the tone for this, our Earth Day show, and the third of our three-part Unnatural Disaster series on nuclear power plant accidents. The May-June issue of Mother Jones magazine arrived in my postal mailbox a few days ago. I recently broke my paper fast to subscribe because I love their spin on current events and social movements, and I was still carrying in my visual memory a prescient image from some years ago of one of their covers that showed a nude Statue of Liberty posed to protect her privacy, and a caption that read, "Hands off my data." But I might have to drop my subscription if they keep featuring Donald Trump caricatures on their cover. But I digress. Facing page 64 is a full-page ad by an organization called Negative Population Growth that says, quote, "If we want to protect our environment, we must talk about population size and growth," end quote. Why must marketing language be so characterized by coercion? While I agree about the importance of having this conversation, I don't delude myself by thinking it's going to protect our environment, by which I assume they mean our habitat and the web of life with which we share it so poorly, any more than does the Environmental Protection Agency. The NPG ad cites the by-now common knowledge that the U.S. has less than 5% of the world's population, but uses more than 20% of the world's resources, and goes on to feature some additional alarming statistics that point to the endemic wetticocycosis we've been discussing on recent Sequitur shows. U.S. population has more than doubled since 1950. According to the World Population Clock, in the U.S. alone, another person is born every 16 seconds. U.S. garbage creation has tripled since 1960. Say what? The U.S. loses 50 acres of farm and ranch land per hour to overdevelopment.
Hello, everybody. It's Benjamin the Donkey. Forests to deserts. The story about humankind features habitats which have declined. We keep ourselves fed clearing forests ahead and leaving just deserts behind. Hee-haw!
Exactly. Thanks, Benji. You know, as you were speaking, I had a compelling image of Ms. Pac-Man gobbling up all those little dots along her path. Only when we clear our board, there are no flashing lights and next level. We're just as dead as if one of the ghosts caught up with us and ate us.
You know, this doom thing would work out a whole lot better if there was some way of stopping it.
But there are no throbbing energizer dots to eat that will turn the ghosts blue so we can chase them down and eat them and score massive amounts of points, right?
We can make an electric broom and rockets that vroom when they zoom and a boom from the bloom of a nuclear plume, but we do not know how to stop doom. We can all sit around in the gloom discussing great issues that loom. What's more, we presume someone cares when we fume, yet and still, that doesn't stop doom. In conclusion, then, we must assume, when there's nothing left to exhume from our womb and our tomb, that it all went kaboom, 'cause we did not know how to stop doom.
Rest in peace, Homo sapiens sapiens. You know, Benji, with all those internal rhymes, it sounds like you've been hanging out with Dr. Seuss.
Hee-haw!
As I took some time off from preparing my script for this show and was on the way to a biweekly Zoom meeting with Carolyn Baker and Dean Walker's support group, I saw the latest Deep Green release by Derek Jensen, produced by Ivy Cohn. Titled Lies and Silence, it offers additional insight into why it is that this topic fills me with intense emotions as a mother and grandmother, as you might have surmised from Sequitur Earthbound last time. I transcribed a bit from the early part of the segment so I could share it with you. Quote, "In order for us to maintain our way of living, we must, in a broad sense, tell lies to each other, and especially to ourselves. It's not necessary that the lies be particularly believable. The lies act as barriers to truth. These barriers to truth are necessary, because without them, many deplorable acts would become impossibilities. Truth must at all cost be avoided. When we do allow self-evident truths to percolate past our defenses and into our consciousness, we treat them like so many hand grenades rolling across the dance floor of a probably macabre party. We try to stay out of harm's way, afraid they'll go off, shatter our delusions, and leave us exposed to what we've done to the world and to ourselves, exposed as the hollow people we've become. And so we avoid these truths, these self-evident truths, and continue the dance of world destruction." Unquote. And then he looked down and said, quote, "In many ways, that's all of my work right there." Close quote. But I am in service to truth and have identified safety as one of the diabolical trinity of non-values that supports the lies, along with convenience and low prices. At the same time, I have found enough humility to admit that despite my best efforts to drop out of the dance of world destruction, I am a product of thousands or tens of thousands of years of cultural evolution and just as addicted to my postmodern privilege as Donald Trump is to his, despite the obvious difference in the objective level of privilege that separates us and causes he and I to other each other. So, given the constraints of my circumstances, The most I can do is detonate those grenades by calling destruction by its proper name when I see it. And that's also the least I can do for Gaia and for all my relations. How about it, Benji? Want to dance?
Hee-haw!
Yes, I know. You told me you have two left feet. As for me, I'm pretty lame for fancy footwork myself. But you're my comrade in detonating the hand grenades of truth, so it doesn't matter if we stumble a bit. Look at them all over the dance floor.
In 1964, in Of Men and Galaxies, Sir Fred Hoyle said, "With coal gone, oil gone, high-grade metallic ores gone, no species, however competent, can make the long climb from primitive conditions to high-level technology. This is a one-shot affair. If we fail, this planetary system fails so far as intelligence is concerned. The same will be true of other planetary systems. On each of them, there will be one chance and one chance only. One-shot affair. Look on our works and despair. The resources are no longer there. To support such advance, there was only one chance. This was a one-shot affair."
How sad. We missed, didn't we, Benji?
Hee-haw.
Another information source I follow is the Climate Central newsletter, which recently included an item that illustrates how even the best of news sources are complicit in the obfuscation Jensen describes. Quote, "The National Park Service has been a climate leader in the federal government, preparing parks for changes. But it's a vast system, with 417 sites under its purview. It also faces a $12 billion maintenance backlog." Close quote. Let's follow the money and stand by for the blame game. Former National Park Service Director Jonathan Jarvis said, quote, "Now we're faced with managing parks under a much more difficult, complicated system." Close quote. Climate Central reports that while Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke, who oversees national parks, did acknowledge climate change in his hearing, quote, "he also questioned how big humans' contribution was, a view outside established climate science," close quote. Say what? Since when is climate science unable or unwilling to quantify the human contribution? Climate Central continues, quote, "That makes it an open question as to whether the agency will continue to be a leader in climate change over the next 4 years," close quote. Say what? Since when does a $12 billion maintenance backlog, together with the increasingly commonplace practice of allowing so-called resource extraction in supposedly protected places, a demonstration of climate change leadership? But the most I could do, and the least I could do, is to report the truth here, and choose the National Park series when I went to the post office to purchase stamps last Monday. I never choose flags, and I very rarely choose people. I invited John Cossum to contribute a segment on Earth Day for today's show. John is known by some as a master composter and a deep green, as opposed to a bright green like people like Al Gore and Bill McKibben. John is known by others as a light-hearted kids entertainer called Professor Fiddlesticks, who juggles and rides a unicycle and makes balloon animals. But the professor has a serious scientific side, too, as you'll hear. Trigger alert! John has addressed a topic just as controversial as negative population growth. But stay with it and see if you can take a quantum approach to truth. While it is true that facts are facts, alternative interpretations are possible. As Dorothy Gale says to her dog upon realizing that she has entered an alternative reality, "Toto, I've a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore." John Cossum, your mic is live.
Thank you, Susan. This is John Cossum here, speaking from York, in the UK. So, this episode, we're celebrating Earth Day. So Earth Day was started in 1970 in the United States after an oil spill in California. And the first one, on April the 22nd, saw 20 million Americans getting involved. This event led to the development of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Endangered Species Act. So it was a very highly successful event. In 1990, Earth Day went international, and approximately 200 million people were participants. This paved the way for the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, which in my mind was one of the most important of the UN summits, because it gave us Agenda 21. And in the 1990s, I was very active in York local Agenda 21. And we did a lot of good work to promote sustainability and participation, public participation. However, I never really got connected in with Earth Day. And that might sound odd, coming from a deep green environmentalist like me. I think possibly the idea of one special day to focus on green living really didn't appeal to me. I was living every day an Earth Day. I've lived a low-carbon lifestyle for coming up towards 30 years now, and I consider my impact on the planet every day, more than once a day. For me, one Earth Day a year didn't really mean very much. I'm not against it, because I think that if it helps move people towards a more environmentally friendly way of living, or teaches them about sustainability, helps them think about it, encourages them to start doing something new or to give something up, then I'm happy with that. Earth Day this year has got a very interesting addition. It's called the March for Science. And this is to celebrate and promote evidence-based policy making and funding for scientific research. This is in response to the USA's administration's cuts to the funding of many science organizations and the administration's denial that anthropogenic climate change is a thing, or indeed is a problem. The March for Science is something I can really feel supportive of. I'm a scientist. I could march in a March for Science. So I should be watching with interest. I might even take part. I don't know if there's a March for Science in my city, but I shall be watching with interest. And one area interests me more than most, and this is slightly controversial. Or maybe it's very controversial. Let's find out. The subject is the generation of electricity from nuclear fission. Now, this one is a real hot potato. Many of my friends still count nuclear electricity along with nuclear bombs. And in history, in historical terms, there was definitely a connection, because the same research labs that were generating nuclear material for bomb making were also looking at getting other uses from it. There isn't so much of a connection today, I believe. I'm obviously not pro-nuclear warhead. I'm not happy about nuclear stockpiles. I think you'd be mad to be comfortable with those. And there are plenty of mad people around who think it's a good defence, but that's a different subject. There's also a great fear of radioactivity. And I think radioactivity is poorly understood by average people, possibly because it's invisible, and high doses of radioactivity are known to kill people. But the evidence-based science crew will point out that per gigawatt hour of electricity generated It is by far the safest way to generate electricity. Although there have been two recent big accidents with Chernobyl and Fukushima, these actually haven't killed a lot of people, and the evidence suggests that not a lot of people are going to die because of this. And yes, there is a problem with Fukushima still leaking, but there's also a lot of fake news about the increase in radioactivity, for instance, on the west coast of the United States. The increase in radioactive isotopes is measurable, but only a fraction of the natural background radiation. There's also a lot of talk about what to do with the waste, with the high-level waste or spent fuel. And people often say, what are we going to do with all the waste? Well, nuclear electricity doesn't actually produce a lot of waste. The amount generated from one person's annual electricity use, if they were to get all their electricity from a nuclear power station, the high-level waste or spent fuel is about 30 grams per person per year. That's an ounce, or about 6 teaspoons full if you were to do an ounce of water. This material can be incorporated into glass blocks and stored ideally underground. And that's what I think we should be doing with it. There are people opposed to storing this material underground. Now, obviously, there's a lot of low-level material, like lab coats and buildings, which need to be treated with caution, but these are not difficult items to manage. They're not very radioactive, and their radioactivity in them will decay in the next few decades. I'm not a big fan of nuclear energy generally, but I'm balanced on it. I'm not against it, and I'm not for it. However, I do support the research into fail-safe nuclear reactors, such as thorium and molten salt reactors, mainly because they are low carbon and they are the most heavily regulated industry for safety. Every little incident that happens is looked at very, very carefully, and every incident results in the whole system being reviewed and getting safer. So I have a certain amount of trust that they're being managed in a safe way, as safe as possible. And yes, there are worries about all sorts of things that could happen to them, but so far, per amount of electricity that's been generated, nuclear power is safe and very, very low carbon. It's something that when you have a Science March and Earth Day on the same day, it means we have to have that conversation. We have to debate about whether the constant power that nuclear electricity can give us is something that we should be exploring and developing. Now, when it comes to electricity, I'm a big fan of renewables. Solar, wind, hydro, small-scale local biomass, anaerobic digestion for biogas, and then techniques like heat pumps, passive solar design, and super-insulated homes, which give you a passive house standard. But we must remember that currently, renewables are not constant, and that they cannot give us a good base load. So we would have to develop some way of storing energy, and that's not easy. We've also got to remember that in the UK at least, only 20% of our national total energy demand is met by electricity. 20% is electricity. All the rest is gas, that's about 30% of our national energy use, is gas, and that's mainly in domestic properties for central heating and cooking. And then 50% of our national energy use is liquid fuels. It's petrol, gasoline, diesel, aviation fuel, that kind of thing. 50% is liquid fuel, fossil fuel. And we have to remember that replacing the liquid fossil fuels with biofuels, in the lab we can do it, but it's actually really difficult. The idea of being able to replace all that petrol and diesel and aviation fuel with biofuel, we just don't have the space to do it, to actually grow the plants that will make the vegetable oil or make the maize that we can ferment into alcohol. I don't see that as a sustainable thing at all, to be honest. So on Earth Day, we need to think about quite a few different issues. We need to think about our domestic energy use, both our electricity and our gas. We need to ideally reduce the amount of gas, because there's no way that we can get gas from renewable sources apart from a tiny amount of biogas from anaerobic digesters. We could switch our energy supplier to one that gives us 100% renewable electricity. That's what I'm with. And I recommend that. If you can ask your electricity supplier what percentage of renewables they supply, and if it's not enough for you and you're not happy with that, find one that supplies more. In the UK, there are several companies that give you 100% renewable electricity. We definitely need to think carefully about our transport. Our transport based on cars and lorries transporting things around is all done with fossil fuels. You need to get on your bike, to walk, to use public transport, and just dump the car. You really, really cannot be a car user if you're trying to be green. Unless, of course, you've got a 100% renewable electricity supplier and you've got an electric car. You've still got the battery to think about, and there's a lot of embodied energy in the battery. But I like battery development. I think that's important. We need to find ways of storing electricity. Of course, our energy use in the UK has gone down recently over the past few years as we've imported more goods from abroad. And that means that the pollution associated with those goods is now being produced abroad. So instead of things being manufactured in the UK and the carbon dioxide emissions coming from that manufacture going into UK air, we're now buying in from the Far East, and the pollution is caused over there with coal-fired power stations. So we need to think globally. We just need to cut our consumption levels overall. Doesn't matter where the stuff is made, we need to use less of it. Other Earth Day issues would include considering how we help biodiversity, and that's another massive subject. But if you've got a garden, you're in a very good position to help biodiversity. And one really good way to help the planet is to plant trees. It's a bit late in the year to plant a tree, but maybe this year you can harvest some nuts and seeds from trees around you and grow them in pots, or plant them in the winter and grow some trees. So for me, Earth Day is going to be looking at the science and trying to help people understand the complicated science that surrounds environmentalism or sustainability. And for me, Earth Day will be like any other, I'm sure. I should be trying to live a low carbon lifestyle and thinking about my diet and my energy use and my resource use and how much stuff I throw away and how I travel, switching off things. And that will just be a normal day for me. And I hope it becomes, the Earth Day experience becomes a normal day for more people. Because really, the Earth does deserve a better treatment than we're giving it. So happy Earth Day, everybody.
You're listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace. Personal, powerful, and heart to heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
Christian doesn't ask what would Jesus do, then I don't know what a Christian is. And if a Buddhist doesn't ask what would Buddha do, then I don't know what a Buddhist is. And if a Muslim doesn't ask what would Muhammad do, then I don't know what the Islam is. And if a human being doesn't question his actions, I don't know what a human being is. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, our perception's gone astray. We think we own the earth and we treat her like a slave. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, let's reevaluate our role in this experience and choose to change our ways. Oh, earthlings, earthlings. Oh, you know that I'm gonna sing it again. If a Christian doesn't ask what would Jesus do, I don't know what a Christian is. And if a Buddhist doesn't ask what would Buddha do, then I don't know what a Buddhist is. And if a Muslim won't ask what will Muhammad do, then I don't know what Islam is. And if a human being doesn't question his actions, I don't know what a human being is. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, our perception's gone astray. We think we own the earth and we treat her like a slave. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, let's reevaluate our role in this experience and choose to change our ways. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, put aside your guns and bombs and armor trucks and realize that we are one. Oh, earthlings, earthlings, for we are here to love. Yes, la 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 love in this trip around the sun. Oh, earthlings, earthlings. Oh, earthlings, earthlings.
One life, one God, one love. First thing, being, infinity, two, infinity, one.
That was Here to Hear with Earthlings from their self-titled 2009 album. The name of the band is spelled H-E-R-E-I-I, as in the Roman numeral 2, H-E-R-E. You can find more of their music at Bandcamp. Before that, you heard John Compost Cossum, a.k.a. Professor Fiddlesticks, with a presentation on Earth Day. The views he expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Expressions of Peace or Sequitur's other contributors. In fact, I'd like to respond to several of the points John raised. You still with me, Benji?
Yeehaw! Yeehaw!
Okay, Benji, you'll have your chance too. But first, I want to compliment John on the orderly thoroughness of his coverage. I loved his narrative of the history of Earth Day, how it gave rise to federal legislation, for whatever that's worth. I also liked the way he parsed our Earth Day agenda into four key domains: resource consumption, rethinking our needs for transport, protecting biodiversity, and rethinking our strategies for generating electricity. Rather than repeat what we said about the first three on previous shows, I'll just refer interested listeners to the Sequitur Archives under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. 1. Reducing consumption. John Cossum contributed a lovely segment about his low-carbon lifestyle for Buy Nothing Day for Sequitur Gratitude on reducing consumption and waste stream management. 2. Transport. I promoted participation in Running Wolf's monthly Stop Driving boycott in connection with Earth Day for Sequitur Earthbound to help us consider more deeply whether on-demand mobility is a life-serving need or a machine-serving demand, a status-serving addiction, a greed-based affectation of post-industrial civilization. 3. Biodiversity. Guy McPherson's featured interview for Sequitur, The Great Unraveling, is probably the most comprehensive hour-long presentation I've ever heard from him. As a conservation biologist, his view is from the perspective of habitat degradation as the driver of biodiversity loss, much of which is a result of climate change, which in turn is largely driven by human activity. It was with regard to strategies for generating electricity that John really stuck his neck out by daring to present a balanced view relative to nuclear energy. I admire his courage in submitting such a segment for the grand finale of a three-part series titled Unnatural Disasters, and I agree completely with his thesis that it's a conversation that needs to be had, because people who promote nuclear energy are not evil or ignorant. Some of them simply want everyone's needs to be affordably met. Some of them are brilliant scientists. So it's important to listen to their arguments with an open heart mind. But to my mind, it's also important to consider the non-scientific accounts of the disaster and its aftermath. For example, the death toll objectively attributed to the disaster was 30 or 31, and that doesn't contribute much of a negative direction to the per gigawatt hour safety statistics. But unlike with other energy generation strategies, there are delayed effects, like the increase in cancer rates and crippling or even lethal mutations. And even here, the objective cutoff established by the courts is 5 years. So those whose cancer waits longer than that to be detected are not eligible to be counted or compensated. And most of those with damage that remains invisible 31 years later, such as PTSD and loss of place, lack even the venue to articulate their loss, or, in the case of the non-human beings who were affected, even the capacity to articulate their loss in a language that the self-centered supremacist humans can hear and understand. So I'll take a few moments to attempt to speak on their behalf. What happened in the early hours on April 26, 1986, is that Unit 4 at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant exploded due to a mismanaged routine equipment test and released radioactive material into the air. The ensuing nuclear fire burned for 10 days, releasing 400 times as much radiation as the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Two of the most persistent isotopes are cesium-137, which chemically mimics potassium, and strontium-90, which imitates calcium. The explosion was not reported by Soviet authorities for 2 days, during which winds carried the fallout across Europe until experts in Sweden went public with concerns about what they were detecting. About 600,000 first responders, often referred to as Chernobyl's liquidators, were sent in to fight the fire at the nuclear plant and clean up the worst of the contamination. 30 workers died either from the explosion or from acute radiation sickness within the next several months. Most of those 600,000 liquidators are now either sick or dead. Some 350,000 citizens were evacuated over the course of the next few days from an area about the size of the state of Rhode Island, and eventually from an area twice that size, about evenly distributed between what is now Ukraine and Belarus. Millions of unsuspecting citizens in towns and villages in the region were exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. The final death toll from Chernobyl is subject to speculation due to uncertainty of the long-term effects of radiation and the impossibility of controlling for other contributing factors. The World Health Organization estimates that 9,000 people died as a result of this accident. Greenpeace claims the number is 10 times that many. Pripyat, a company town founded in 1970 to provide a residence for the Chernobyl plant workers and their families, was located just a few kilometers from the plant and had a population of some 50,000. Pripyat was just one among the hundreds of towns and villages that were completely and permanently evacuated on short notice. The people had been told they would be able to return in a few days, but that didn't happen. Instead, the city of Slavuchik was built, and the workers and their families moved in with just their handful of belongings and their important papers and applied to join the cleanup workforce. When the last working reactor at Chernobyl was shut down in 2001, most of the jobs went with it. Today, about a third of the former workforce remain to maintain and monitor the defunct plant and to construct a replacement sarcophagus to re-enclose the still vulnerable core of reactor number 4 for the next 100 years. So competition for jobs is fierce, and corruption is rampant. The cost of the project is estimated at 2 billion euro, or 2.25 billion U.S. dollars. Once the structure is in place, work will begin to remove the reactor and its 200 tons of lava-like radioactive waste. And do what with it, I wonder? Ship it to the global radioactive dump in Buford, South Carolina? Meanwhile, the U.S. sends its cast-off plastics and textile waste to dumps in India and Southeast Asia. It would be ludicrous if it were not so tragic.
Yeah. Stratosphere sulfate. Technological fix comes on strong. Dump debris where it doesn't belong. With no way to repair yet more crap in the air, what could possibly go wrong?
You're right, Benji. I digress. Let's get back to the subject at hand, shall we?
Yeehaw!
There are currently about 150 people living in Pripyat. These illegal residents, whose average age is 75, were among more than 1,000 who never accepted the forced evacuation, but returned to live in the officially sealed-off area, presumably to be near ancestral burial sites. Visiting relatives must obtain special passes and are only allowed to stay for 3 days. Tourists can obtain day passes, and workers are deployed to the exclusion zone for only a handful of hours per month. Scientists say it will be 20,000 years before people can live there safely again. In a remarkable demonstration of resilience, studies have found that populations of large mammals such as elk, roe deer, red deer, wild boar, and wolves are more abundant in the 4,200 square kilometer Chernobyl exclusion zone than they were before the accident, and more abundant than in nearby wildlife reserves, despite evidence of major radiation effects and pronounced reductions in populations immediately following the disaster. However, Jim Smith of the University of Portsmouth in the UK admonishes, quote, "This doesn't mean radiation is good for wildlife, just that the effects of human habitation, including hunting, farming, and forestry, are a lot worse." Close quote. Plant life, too, is recovering from the nuclear disaster and the underlying human infestation, as you can see in the featured image for this podcast at panina.org. The forest, dubbed the Red Forest for the reddish-brown bark coloration that is symptomatic of radiation sickness and the standing ones, is advancing to hide the human travesty, also known as industrial civilization. But as with the large mammals, the immediate impact was complete devastation. Most of us are familiar with the way contamination becomes concentrated as it moves up the food chain. An example of this is provided by the wild boar who live in the Sumava Mountains shared by Czechs, Austrians, and Germans. Boar meat was a traditional ethnic delicacy among the Czechs before the Chernobyl disaster, but the boar feed on a variety of underground mushroom that can absorb monstrous amounts of the cesium-137 that was released from the Chernobyl plant. Jiří Drapal of the State Veterinary Administration in the Czech Republic reports that 47% of the boar that were inspected for radioactivity from 2014 to 2016 were found to be above the legal limit. And if you haven't heard Helen Caldicott admonish us not to eat dried apricots from Turkey, I strongly recommend that you do a YouTube search for her name. These places are, of course, a long, long way from the exclusion zone.
Yeehaw! The future's just fine, I would think, for those on extinction's brink who like habitation in nuke radiation and don't need to breathe, eat, or drink. Yeehaw!
Right. Well, you know, in the Ukraine, regulations are not so strict, and the people are more impoverished and therefore hungrier. There is a sense that if they haven't died yet after 3 decades of exposure, then eating radioactive meat isn't going to kill them. Today's young adults, in their infancy at the time of the disaster, are not concerned about losing 20 years from their life expectancy. Poachers in police uniforms shoot animals from helicopters and sell the contaminated meat on the black market. Roe deer and wild boar caught here in the early 1990s exceeded safety norms for cesium-137 by a factor of 2,000. Though internal radiation levels have since dropped dramatically, some animals recently tested in Belarus still exceeded safety levels by dozens of times. Yet aside from some albino splotches, the animals look perfectly normal. However, it is important to remember that seriously deformed mutant animals die or are killed in the wild, and thus are not counted. Canadian scientist Tim Mousseau, professor of biology and co-director of the Chernobyl and Fukushima research initiatives at the University of South Carolina, published findings in the journal Ecologia in March 2014, confirming that the Red Forest is a microbial dead zone. The research question presented itself 7 years earlier, when in the course of studying more macro effects of the disaster, He and his team noticed the unusually large, soft mat of fresh leaf litter on the forest floor, and the trees, killed instantaneously in the initial explosion, were not in the least decayed. Mousseau and his team distributed more than 600 bags of leaf litter collected from similar species at uncontaminated sites to sites at varying distances from ground zero, and thus with varying levels of radioactivity, some wrapped in mesh so that insects could pass through, and others in pantyhose so that only bacteria could contribute to the decomposition process. After the first year, the leaves in areas with no radiation were 70% to 90% gone, while those nearest to the zone of exclusion were still about 60% intact by weight. There was no significant difference due to the type of bag used, so they concluded it was the microbes and fungi that made the difference, with little, if any, contribution from insect activity. Humans don't eat trees, so the main threat of all that tinder-dry radioactive wood is the threat of wildfire releasing the contaminants into the atmosphere as smoke. In other studies, Mousseau and his team also found increased cataracts, smaller brains, and genetic damage among small mammals and birds. He has little faith in the widely accepted lifetime threshold of 100 millisieverts as a safeguard against increased risk of cancer. Quote, "The truth is, that's a completely arbitrary limit. Certainly, the probability of disease increases as the exposure goes up." End quote. But probability is a meaningless number if you or your loved ones are among those who are affected. Local youth known as stalkers, after the protagonists in Roadside Picnic, a 1971 science fiction novel by Arkady and Boris Strugatsky, adapted as the movie Stalker by Russian filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky, and as a video game by the Ukrainian developer Sergei Grigorovich, who make regular illegal surveillance forays into the exclusion zone, to Pripyat, and to Reactor 4, report 12-foot-long catfish swimming in its long-defunct cooling pond. Some analysts say that the Chernobyl disaster was the original crack in the totalitarian armor of the former Soviet Union that culminated in the dissolution of that dinosaur. Might the same be said of the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico and the increasingly leaky ship of state, also known as the USA? Let us not forget the 7th anniversary of that unnatural disaster. On 20 April 2010, an explosion and fire on BP's Deepwater Horizon oil rig spewed more than 4 million gallons of crude oil in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 workers were presumed dead, having disappeared without a trace. If you haven't yet seen Panina's Expressions of Peace, Stand Up for Peace, the documentary of Open University at Occupy Cal's Flash Mob Street Theater reenactment of this event in Sproul Fountain at UC Berkeley, where Mario Savio gave the speech that ignited the free speech movement, you can find it at vimeo.com/expressionsofpeace. Just scroll down and click on Stand Up for Peace. The so-called cleanup was really a cover-up. Corexit, the substance used to make the oil go away, wherever that is, created a toxic petrochemical mist that traveled 100 miles inland as it forced the oil slick to the sea floor, where it sits to this day, a gummy, toxic mess that is inhospitable to the abundant marine life that used to live there and comprise sustenance and livelihood for people all along the coast. Massive amounts of clean sand were imported so that beaches could be reopened to harvest the tourist dollars. I remember being appalled at the good-hearted animal rescue people using toothbrushes and Dawn dishwashing detergent, itself a petrochemical toxin in high concentrations, to clean pelicans so weighted down with oil that they couldn't fly, and crying out, "But what about the plankton?"
You know, Homo sapiens psychology, which some may label pathology, might now seem inept, but has not changed except it uses advanced technology.
Indeed, pathologically clever we are. Did I tell you what our friend Elizabeth West had to say about this clever species? Quote, "Every day I'm less convinced that the survival of this species is an optimal outcome." Close quote.
Yeehaw!
Sobering, eh? Here are some of the sub-lethal consequences of the Deepwater Horizon disaster reported by local divers, residents, and fishermen in the first 3 years after it occurred. Memory loss, cognitive disorders, miscarriages, skin rashes, kidney damage, and bleeding from the eyes, breasts, and anus. Some of these conditions will no doubt escalate to lethal stature, but they will be attributed to the medical diagnosis at the time of death, not to the disaster. Corexit was also used to remediate the 24 March 1989 Exxon Valdez spill, which officially reported zero human casualties, but everyone from the cleanup crews has subsequently died at an average age at death of just 51 years. So I wanted to acknowledge these non-nuclear unnatural disasters just for balance, so that proponents of nuclear power production won't feel picked on. From where I sit, both fossil fuel and nuclear energy are ecocidal undertakings. We have indeed become death, the destroyer of worlds. In his segment, John Cossum echoed a familiar critique of renewables on the basis that they are not constant and cannot be expected to provide as reliable a power source as that to which we have become accustomed. To which I respond, "Oh, well, where does that attitude of entitlement come from?" My objective critique of so-called renewables has more to do with the untold human suffering and violent extraction technologies required to obtain the resources needed to create the development infrastructure. But there's a subjective element there, too, that has to do with hubris and wetico, with endless extraction of more than we need and giving nothing back. And I was shocked to hear his dismissive attitude about storage of nuclear waste. 30 grams per year per person is a non-zero amount, and just because it's not carbon doesn't make it okay. Demand for more and more energy and the generation of more and more radioactive waste to provide terrorist targets will only increase as population increases. Indeed, do the math and watch the curve go exponential when you multiply by population and look at cumulative totals. In other words, you don't start each year with zero. No, the buck stops here, now. Less is more. Decrease the demand for energy and will increase sovereignty and freedom from addiction to convenience, the illusion of safety, and low prices. John also promoted participation in the March for Science, as did I when I first heard it was happening. However, as Earth Day grew closer and the mainstream science community and the event organizers articulated the themes of the march, my enthusiasm evaporated. Promoting science-based policymaking and protesting research funding cuts is nothing more nor less than more neoliberal business as usual. Why not promote spiritually based policymaking, which is older than time, costs a lot less, and does not rely on transient political and corporate whims? That's a rhetorical question that begs a discussion of integrity, community, and self-responsibility. Personally, I have done a complete 180-degree turnaround from a 10-year career as a science teacher to a student of shamanism, with a strong preference for indigenous wisdom for the sake of its unique combination of long-standing viability and immediacy of effect, in contrast to the ponderous peer review process required to establish scientific truth and legislative process to implement centralized government policy, especially when that truth affects livelihoods and those policies cost tax dollars that are desperately needed to fund wars, build border walls, and subsidize our favorite industries to reduce their costs to consumers and support the sustainability of business as usual. I'm kidding about that last bit, of course. I favor a tax rebate to all citizens, with the remaining corporate taxes retained to finance the peaceful dissolution of the IRS and the federal government along with it. No, I won't march for a greater share in the capitalist economy to continue the practice of monetizing knowledge. This greedy species will never have enough money or scientific knowledge to dispel its fear of scarcity or satisfy its addictive craving for more, bigger, faster. With John, I find the correspondence of a March for Science on Earth Day highly significant, but while it was inspiring for him, for me it was discouraging to see a day to celebrate our love for our Mother Gaia co-opted as a day of protest to support job creation. So discouraging that I found it impossible to get this show ready to release on Earth Day as I had originally intended. Scientists are wage slaves, too. They are just as owned as any other sector of the workforce. I got some relief as the day grew near and I noticed the proliferation of local events more in line with the original spirit of the holiday. Teach-ins, sustainable potlucks featuring homegrown food with crowdsourced reusable tableware, and reskilling workshops to help us remember the crafts and trades that will make life wonderful, even when, not if, the grid goes down. My generation and my children's generation are arguably the most unskilled cohorts that have ever walked this planet on two legs. It's good to see my grandchildren's generation recovering some of those skills and developing new, low-tech ways of being that might at least keep them comfortable in these end times.
You know, technology isn't a way we can end up saving the day, but it seems beyond doubt that there is no way out, so whatever, I guess it's okay. Yee-haw!
Whatever. Remember the Cornell University panel on 11 March 2016 discussed on Sequitur on Natural Disaster 2 last month? The third panelist was Sonia Smith of Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, who spoke about her extensive archival research in the former USSR about the Chernobyl disaster. She emphasized the fundamental causal importance of the interaction among cultural, technological, organizational, and psychological factors that are not recognized by the so-called rule of law, which looks only at immediate causes in isolation. Three factors are usually exhaustively investigated and all damages attributed to them. 1. Human error. 6 people, 3 of them senior managers, were tried in a semi-public trial and sentenced to 10 years in labor camp. 2. Design flaws are cited to dismiss disasters as unique and foreign rather than investigating the good reasons why those choices were ever made or allowed. 3. Systems explanations blame cultural mindset or organizational structure and function without considering that these things were themselves products of a long evolutionary process. In response to the question of whether nuclear power can ever be made safe enough, Dr. Schmid said, quote, "The question is not so much can we find out what the real risk is, but who gets to define what risk we prioritize and we focus on." The ultimate lesson is that we can no longer have technocrats, scientists, and engineers in charge, defining the real risk and then solving it, and the rest of the population just watches. End quote. From the same panel, Dr. Perot spoke eloquently against nuclear power plants, asked how it can be that between 40 and 60 of them are currently under construction, reported that in the month prior to the panel, there were 4 incidents of radioactive leaks into freshwater sources in the U.S. alone, and the only sanctions that resulted were a trivial reprimand and the assessment of a fine. Water is life. I wonder how many such unspectacular leaks go undetected. Yet we continue to blame the sixth extinction on climate chaos, thus perversely providing the nuclear power industry with a rationalization for their more, bigger, faster production. And that moves me to a brief and not at all comprehensive update on pipeline leaks. If I try to be comprehensive, this show will never get posted. Every time I check my notifications, someone is reporting on another one. One in particular caught my eye, though, for its low profile despite its enormous magnitude and its proximity to the high-profile action at Standing Rock. In an interview dated 27 February, North Dakota Health Department environmental scientist Bill Swiss told the Alternative Media Syndicate that less than a third of the 840,000 gallons of oil from possibly the largest land-based spill on Turtle Island has been cleaned up nearly 4 years after the spill, and probably never will be. The nearest town is Tioga, North Dakota, in the northwestern corner of the state, and nowhere near any waterways or population centers. There was another smaller spill in early December that was also in a sparsely populated area and similarly did not affect any waterways. Last month, a pipeline break in Belfield, South Dakota, about 150 miles to the south of Tioga and about the same distance west of Standing Rock, spewed an estimated 176,000 gallons of oil into a creek that feeds into the Little Missouri River, which in turn joins the Missouri. These are parts of a large network of 6-inch steel pipelines that crisscross the western Dakota's oil patch. By comparison, the Dakota Access Pipeline is made of 30-inch steel pipes and will carry nearly 20 million gallons daily. Pipeline executives suggest that lightning might have been responsible for the ruptures, which is perversely amusing, since climate scientists warn of increasingly intense storms in our immediate future.
Oh, the weather outside is storming, and habitats keep transforming. And since, as we know, we've no place to go, good thing there's no global warming. Hee-haw!
Exactly. And the cleanup process is expensive, labor-intensive, and extremely noisy, which means lots of jobs will be created when, not if, DAPL ruptures, whether due to human error, design flaws, grid failure, sabotage, or natural causes such as lightning. As with nuclear power plant disasters, only those humans who have the courtesy to die in the apocalyptic moment will count as casualties. The rest will have to settle for money in exchange for their ruined farmland, water supply, homeland, communities, and health, assuming they win their convoluted court cases. And of course, the non-human beings who are impacted will be completely ignored. Unfortunately, both nuclear and oil are subject to non-apocalyptic low-level leaks that can go unnoticed for years. Finally, speaking of Standing Rock, you might conclude that the war is over and Energy Transfer Partners won, but the eviction and evacuation of the water protector camps is only the beginning. The courage and determination that was demonstrated there has earned the attention, respect, and support of luminaries such as Jane Fonda, Bernie Sanders, Cornel West, Van Jones, Amy Goodman, Starhawk, Neil Young, and others, and is documented in a new movie produced and directed by Josh Fox and Indigenous collaborators titled Awake, A Dream from Standing Rock. More important, it has given rise to a global movement that features a diversity of tactics, including nonviolent direct action and an ongoing campaign of financial divestment, as well as the prayer vigils that characterized the movement last year. The movie is available online for a self-determined donation until 6 May, and, quote, 100% of the proceeds will go to an Indigenous Media Fund and a Pipeline Fighters Fund supervised by the film's creators and a council of Indigenous leaders to support direct actions, Indigenous filmmakers, and journalists, end quote. Scroll down to view the trailer and click through to make a donation and get access to the film, which you can view as often as you like on a wide variety of devices. Panina has already made a $20 donation and has further pledged to donate an additional dollar on 6 May for every comment viewers make on this page after viewing the film. Thank you in advance for your caring participation. I'm signing off with my sincerest wishes for a lively and love-filled Beltane for all, and with special thanks to John Cossum for the Earth Day segment, to Debekale Earnshaw for the poetry reading, to Hear for the Earthlings song, to Benjamin the Donkey for his sometimes irreverent but always enlightened commentary, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
What connects us is one.